Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated November 14th, 2014. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's lead article, on the front page, lawyers in love with their new digs. Triangle law firms are lining up for makeovers to obtain more efficient, millennial-friendly workspaces. This article is by Amanda Jones Hoyle. A law firm's office is its lair. It's a status symbol designed to invoke trust, control, and confidentiality. That much hasn't changed since the era of smoky boardrooms and dark mahogany libraries, but how law firms design and utilize their office space is changing. Taking cues from clients, Triangle area law firms are adding coffee bars and cafes where partners, associates, and staff can meet for lunch or quick meetings. They are flipping floor plans so that partners aren't the only people with a window view. At last count, at least a dozen law firms in the Raleigh-Durham area have embarked on an ambitious office remake. They are shrinking the size of the lawyer's own personal space and, in many places, incorporating a one-size-fits-all model for attorney offices. All this may be designed for one primary reason: price pressure. Abundance of competition from smaller firms is pushing billing rates down nationwide, and companies, individuals, and associations are fleeing outfits unwilling to compromise on billing methods and scale. While billing rates address the top line, many law firms are looking for ways to streamline its Cadillac-style physical space to reduce cost. Coupled with the changing face of America's workforce, with the millennials leading the pack, it has now become essential for law firms to reimagine their working quarters. As an industry, law firms typically have allocated one of the highest levels of square footage per employee and invested more in finer furnishings and decor in an office space compared to other major office space users. But research shows that law firms are changing their approach to real estate. In 2013, when law firms moved from one building to another, the new building they were moving into was 7.1% smaller than their previous floor plate, according to real estate research firm JLL. Since the end of the recession in June 2009, the number of employees at law firms nationally, as measured by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, is unchanged. In the Triangle, employment among the 25 largest law firms in the region is actually down 1.7% compared to 2008, with fewer support staff and paralegals employed by the firms, according to Triangle Business Journal research. Revenue for law firms is being challenged as some corporate clients move toward performing legal work in-house, and as some firms move away from the hourly rate equation toward alternative fee arrangements, such as fixed fees or value billing. A U.S. Census Bureau measure of total legal services revenues show that total revenue growth nationally has been anemic at best, with an average 1.6% increase in yearly revenue in each of the past 5 years. Over the last 18 months, at least a dozen law firms in the Triangle have either expanded, relocated, or hired an architecture firm to evaluate the changing technology and real estate needs of their legal teams and staff. Law firms make up about 7% of the Triangle's total office market, and that compares to 8% in Charlotte, 16% in Atlanta, 11% in New York City, according to a research report from JLL. Only three law firms, soon to be two, in the Triangle, occupy spaces of 50,000 square feet or more, all in downtown Raleigh. Smith Anderson in the Wells Fargo Capital Center building, Poynier Spruill in the PNC Plaza building, and Womble, Carlisle, Sandridge, and Rice. Womble Carlisle in 2015 will be relocating and shrinking its offices from the 68,000 square feet it currently occupies on three floors in the Wells Fargo Capital Center Tower into about 45,000 square feet on two floors in the new Charter Square building, under construction about two blocks south on Fayetteville Street. In a law firm, one of the biggest expenses is space, says Johnny Loper, managing partner at the Raleigh office of Womble Carlyle. Clients are always demanding you be efficient, and in 2008 that drumbeat picked up in frequency and intensity. So, when the firm started looking 2 years ahead of its lease expiration at the end of 2015, it looked at ways it could also make the office space more efficient and useful. The new Charter Square will have a more open floor plate, Loper says, allowing the firm to fit the same number of people into a smaller space. Law firms, for example, don't need all of the storage capacity previously required for legal documents and discovery as firms adopt paperless technology and systems. Most firms have also all but done away with the voluminous libraries that used to be a centerpiece of a law office, since most statutory and case law research can be conducted through online services. Instead, the emphasis among law firms is on improved technology, especially in the conference room areas, more meeting room spaces or alcoves for collaboration, better break rooms, and more modern furnishings and decor. When the Parker Poe Law Firm moves its Raleigh office from the Wells Fargo Capital Center Tower into its new space in the newer, taller PNC Plaza Tower, it'll be taking about the same amount of square footage as it had before, about 46,000 square feet. But gone will be the traditional regal blue carpet, the winding grand staircase in the lobby, and the never-ending maze of hallways to conference rooms and legal offices. The furniture, lamps, even the staircase have been tagged for sale to the highest bidder. A trade-off in the new space, says Parker Poe's Raleigh managing partner Kevin Shignall, will be that all attorney offices will be the same universal size, about 10 feet by 13 feet, or about half the size of the larger corner offices in the old building. Instead of the traditional corner offices, we turned all corner spaces into collaboration areas where groups can meet informally, work on cases, and exchange ideas, he says. Working with Gensler as its architect, Shignall says they told the group to come up with a design that was so different from the traditional law firm that it would be rejected by its board of directors. We really wanted them to color outside the lines, he said. They used frosted glass panels next to all office doors to bring light into the core, and glass is featured at the end of every east-west hallway to make sure that even the paralegals and legal assistants were not shut out from the stunning window views. All 10 of the conference room areas for clients and visitors are now clustered on one floor, featuring the latest in audio and video technology, as well as a catering kitchen. One of the most expensive features of the new space is the two skyfold doors installed within the ceiling of the largest conference room that can be deployed to fold down to create two or three smaller conference rooms. Shignall estimates the skyfold doors cost about $80,000 each, but they have the same effect as a fully constructed wall in both appearance and acoustical dampening for confidential meetings with clients. In the front lobby, there's an eclectic 10x8 LED art display of interlocking propellers that would seem more fitting in a technology firm or spa than a law office. The firm plans to partner with a local art group to incorporate a rotating art exhibit rather than commission expensive art pieces. We don't have a lot of finishes, but we've tried to maximize what we do have, says Parker Poe partner Jeff Bandini, leader of the firm's real estate practice, who helped lead the relocation process. Our office is younger than most of our other offices, so we tend to be a little edgier. But not all law firms are going to that extreme. When the Ellis & Winters law firm of Cary moved its offices into the new Glen Lake 5 office building in West Raleigh in February, the configurations will not be drastically different from what they are now, says founding partner Mike Winters. He says, we don't need a lot of collaborative space because collaboration tends to be not confidential, he says. I'm not sure where this notion that lawyers sit around and talk about cases came from, but I'm not buying it. John Warsilia, founding principal with Alliance Architecture in Durham, has worked with about 8 different law firms in the Triangle over the past few years in redesigning their workspaces, and a common theme among all of them, he says, is about keeping with the culture of the firm and creating more flexibility. Firms that were built in 1980 with wood-paneled conference rooms were not built with the technology of today, Warsilia says. Using systems furniture for secretarial and paralegal stations helps the firm manage changing roles and assignments over the life of the lease. Many firms are also going through a culture change, he says, as younger attorneys bring new ideas and expectations from the workplace. The Wyrick, Robbins, Yates, and Ponton Law Firm in West Raleigh, which often represents technology companies, completely overhauled its office space over the course of nearly a year last May. The space before was connected only by elevators, so they cut a hole in the floor and built new staircases. They did away with the 2 small break rooms and built a new cafe area, dubbed Periodic Table, which is a focal point of the building and can seat 60 people. We moved into the space in 1989, and when we started, we didn't even have a full floor, remembers Marilee Carson, executive director of the firm. As the firm grew, we took more space, but it was still very disjointed. We wanted our design to link up with our brand. Carlson says they tested the option of making the law offices uniform in size, but the additional cost and renovation far outweighed the benefits of the extra space they would gain. Instead, they brought in more glass to let in more light and switched to lighter wood and livelier colors. It feels more energetic, she says, casually sophisticated. A JLL research study shows that the right-sizing wave among law firms is peaking, but will continue to evolve as rent rates increase and a younger generation of lawyers come in with different expectations for the workspace. For the majority of firms, they are looking at real estate as a way to increase profitability by reducing cost, says John Scalettis, Senior Vice President and Director of Office Research for JLL. 10 years ago, a law firm would have about 850 to 950 square feet of space per lawyer on staff, Scalettis estimates. Today, that ratio is closer to 600 to 650 square feet per lawyer and as low as 550 square feet per lawyer in expensive metro areas like New York City and Washington, D.C. In London, law firms have already moved toward an open workspace model. That's not been embraced by culture here yet, he says. A sidebar to this week's cover story, today's terrain. Nationwide, the ratio of law firm revenue generators to administrative staff has increased in the last decade from 3-to-1 to as high as 8-to-1 in 2014. Law firms that opt for more modern layouts and more efficient workspaces can shrink real estate occupancy footprints by more than 15%. Also, the law office workspace trends, there are fewer workstations needed. Small office sizes shrink the square footage per attorney, and the migrating from as much as 900 square feet per attorney to as low as 550 square feet per attorney. Today's average is about 750 square feet per attorney. And when law firms moved from one building to another in 2013, the new footprint was an average of 7.1% smaller. Average floor plan is 24,554 square feet. Next up, U.S. India champion launches new book. It was a big day for Indian-American Swadesh Chatterjee of Kerry last week. Triangle Business Journal was invited to attend the launch of his memoir, Building Bridges, at Briar Creek Country Club in Raleigh. Chatterjee, who has been involved in developing U.S.-India relations in the past 2 decades, was seen hobnobbing with the former North Carolina Governor Jim Hunt, U.S. Congressman David Price, and North Carolina Secretary of State Elaine Marshall, all of whom acknowledged Chatterjee's relevant contribution in generating a voice for Indian Americans in American policies and politics. North Carolina plays an important role in developing the U.S.-India relations beyond politics, says the 66-year-old winner of one of India's highest civilian honors, the Padma Bhushan Award. Our economic ties are growing stronger that will help both countries. I want to continue to strengthen those ties through dialogue and collaboration. More than 150 people, primarily Indian Americans from the Triangle, showed up for the festive evening. This week's column by Amanda Hoyle. Amanda covers commercial and residential real estate, and her lead article is JDIG Incentive Funding Ends, Final Project on Tap. One of North Carolina's biggest corporate incentive grant programs, the Jobs Development Investment Grant, has maxed out its $22.5 million funding account. And without JDIG, we will not be competitive, North Carolina Commerce Secretary Sharon Decker told members of Research Triangle Chapter NAIOP at its meeting November 7th at the Umstead Hotel in Cary. The JDIG program, since its inception in 2002, has been used by state economic development recruiters to sweeten the pot for companies that are considering a major investment in North Carolina that would lead to the creation of net new jobs in the state. JDIG has typically been reserved for the largest new jobs deal, and payouts are only made after the company reaches a minimum job creation goal. On November 12, the state's Economic Investment Committee approved a JDIG award for Cognizant Technology Solutions, which will be opening an IT operations center in Charlotte and adding 500 jobs statewide. Cognizant already employs 1,487 people in North Carolina and will be required to retain those jobs. With Cognizant grant, JDIG is very, very close to its cap, says Commerce spokeswoman Kim Gennardo. Tax reform has helped us because we are no longer the highest in the Southeast, and that is great, she says, but we will not be competitive for those jobs without JDIG. Decker also hinted that the state is negotiating with at least three companies that are considering major job expansions or relocation projects in the Triangle region in which JDIG funds were being requested. To replenish the fund, Governor Pat McCrory would need to call a special session of the General Assembly. Otherwise, lawmakers would have to wait until the General Assembly's long session convenes on January 14, 2015, to introduce a funding bill. But even if McCrory does call lawmakers for a special session, the proposal could face opposition from lawmakers opposed to economic incentives that benefit individual companies. We are in ongoing discussions about the need for a special session, and that will be based on our economic development and recruitment efforts, McCrory stated through his office. I've said all along that if there is an economic development recruitment decision that has to be made that involves job development grants, and that decision needs to be made before January, then I will call a special session. If a decision is needed and jobs are on the line, I will call for a special session, says the governor. Next up, multi-use project slated for Durham's Gateway site. A Charlotte real estate developer confirms plans to buy the Hendrick Durham Auto Mall property on Roxborough Street in downtown Durham, with plans for a major high-rise mixed-use building project. Charles Lindsay McAlpern, managing partner of Charlotte-based CitySculpt, says he has a hard contract with Hendrick Automotive Group to buy the property from the auto company once the property is vacated in 2015. The Hendrick Durham Auto Mall is relocating to a new site near the streets at South Point Mall. On November 1, Hendrick opened the new Mercedes-Benz of Durham dealership at its new South Durham site. CitySculpt already has an agreement with a luxury apartment developer, Woodfield Investments, to build the first phase of new construction on the Roxborough Street. Site plans should be filed soon. The site is divided in such a way that it could support four pods of development: a high-rise office or medical office building, a transit-oriented development, multifamily apartments, and a dense mixed-use development fronting Roxborough Street. This week in the RTP area, 300 acres on the edge of the RTP sold for development. Apex Building Company, Hale Building Group, has purchased 300 acres of undeveloped land at the edge of the Research Triangle Park on Ellis Road in Durham, with plans to begin a multi-phase, multi-million dollar development of apartment, residential, and commercial construction. Hale paid $10 million for the property purchased from 12 different ownership groups and plans to begin a construction of the first phase, a 336-unit apartment community, as early as March 2015, says Mike Howington, head of Hale Building Group and a vice president for its parent company, the Hale Companies of Silver Spring, Maryland. Also, Breakfast Club, stretch of Glenwood Avenue becoming a hotbed. Krispy Kreme is in negotiations to open a new donut and coffee shop in a building at 6101 Glenwood Avenue in Raleigh that will soon be vacated by the Taverna Agora Greek restaurant. Taverna Agora is relocating to downtown Raleigh in the first quarter of 2015. If the deal happens, it'll complement a number of the new restaurant deals that are turning the quarter-mile stretch of road about 2 miles west of Crabtree Valley Mall into a go-to spot for breakfast, brunch, and lunch options. There's already a flagship location for the buffet-style Golden Corral restaurant, and the Triangle's first franchise for the First Watch breakfast chain has opened next door. Further down the strip, reconstruction of the former Fat Daddy's restaurant building is underway on behalf of the Panera Bread Company, which will be opening a new bakery and restaurant location. Holly Springs Town Center switches to cinema operations, and the firm, Carmike Cinemas, has stepped into takeover plans to build a new movie theater complex at the Holly Springs Town Center after Frank Theaters bowed out of its new location plans in Holly Springs. The new Carmike Cinemas will have 9 stadium-style theater screens and an upscale dining option inside and is expected to open in the fourth quarter of 2015. And Sardi's Den Restaurant joint to open first franchise in Raleigh. Sardi's Den Restaurant and Lounge, a Clemson, South Carolina rib house staple for the past 20 years, will be opening its first franchise location in the Brennan Station Shopping Center on Creedmoor Road in North Raleigh. Sardi's has signed a lease for the 4,416-square-foot space formerly occupied by Oliver Twist, but no opening date has been announced. This week's column by Jason DeBrun covers healthcare and biopharmaceuticals, and his lead article is entitled, After Disclosure, Salix Stock Plunges. There's an inventory audit and shareholder lawsuit to play a role. Salix Pharmaceutical lost nearly $3 billion in market value overnight on November 6 as it reported operating losses. Questions about inventory reporting led to an audit and now a shareholder lawsuit. The company that develops and manufactures gastrointestinal drugs reported a third quarter loss of $89 million, faces an audit for how it reported drug wholesaler inventory levels, missed sales targets, and saw CFO Adam Derbyshire resign unexpectedly, all leading to a nearly 40% drop in share price. For months, executives at Salix led investors and analysts to believe that the wholesaler inventory of its drugs held steady at roughly 10 weeks to 12 weeks, when in fact inventory was as high as 36 weeks for some drugs. Wholesaler inventory is an important measure because they can indicate a difference in reported revenue figures against how many doses of drugs patients are actually taking. As wholesale inventory levels increase, it could artificially inflate earnings figures as a drug maker pushes its products out the door, even if patients aren't buying those drugs at the same rate. Salix management acknowledged that the reported sales figures for the coming 2 years would likely come in below the demand for its drugs as the company ramps down wholesaler inventory levels from 9 months to 3 months. CEO Carol Logan saw the market value of her personal shares drop from $147 million to $95 million. Next up, North Carolina Biotech Center focuses on jobs. The North Carolina Biotechnology Center serves as an economic development driver for the small life science companies in North Carolina. It files as a private nonprofit, but receives appreciably all of its $13.6 million budget from the state taxpayers. Newly named president and CEO Doug Edgerton says that's important because it allows the center to focus its efforts on generating jobs and investments in companies, not turning a profit. In simple terms, the RTP-based biotech outfit serves as an economic developer and resource for small companies in the life sciences industries. Those include drug makers, biodefense companies, and agri-biotech researchers, among others. What the North Carolina Biotechnology Center did in the first quarter? There were 16 loans and grants awarded. The value of those loans and grants was $885,586. They raised in outside funding by companies previously awarded in the NC Biotech loans of $13 million, and $117 amount on average was raised by young life science companies for every dollar invested in them from the North Carolina Biotech loans. There were 19 biotech loan recipients that collected at least $150,000, and $13.6 million was the North Carolina Biotechnology annual budget, generated nearly entirely from North Carolina state taxpayers. Also, Quintiles revenue up, guidance lowered. Pharmaceutical research giant Quintiles topped $1 billion in service revenue for the third quarter, a nearly 14% increase over the same quarter last year. Again, its integrated healthcare services segment grew faster, although from a smaller base, at a rate of 34%. Durham-based Quintiles still generates the bulk of its revenue, $771 million, from helping pharmaceutical companies test and develop new drugs. However, the integrated healthcare services segment has been an up-and-comer and now represents about a quarter of all net revenue. This umbrella includes commercial services, including providing contract pharmaceutical sales forces or consulting and other kinds of healthcare research. Looking ahead, Quintiles lowered revenue guidance by about $40 million based on significant changes in foreign currency and exchange rates. The company pegged revenue guidance at between $4.16 billion and $4.19 billion, a growth of nearly 10% compared with last year. It pegged earnings per share guidance at $2.61 to $2.68 per share, an increase of as much as 30% compared to 2013. Shares traded down about 4% to $55.75 after the earnings announcement. The company's market value is about $7 billion. This week's column of Jason DeBrun, Healthcare and Biopharmaceuticals, has a feature called He Said It. Stephen Fry, director of the Center for Integrative Chemical Biology and Drug Discovery, part of the Eshelman School of Pharmacy at UNC Chapel Hill, after Fred Eshelman, the school's namesake, donated $3 million to help advance the center's drug discovery program. Eshelman, a graduate of the school, is himself no stranger to drug discovery. After founding Pharmaceutical Research Organization, PPD, which was sold for $3.9 billion to the affiliates of the Carlyle Group and of Hellman and Friedman, he founded Furix Pharmaceuticals, which was acquired by Forest Laboratories in a deal that could reach $1.4 billion. Eshelman could stand to make $350 million in the Furix deal. He has now donated a total of $38 million to the School of Pharmacy. He is quoted as saying, "This gift will enable us to advance scientific discoveries made by the UNC facilities by creating new medications to benefit cancer patients." End quote. And the big numbers for this week's biopharmaceutical industry. Raleigh-based pharmaceutical research organization Inc. Research hit public markets on November 7 when it completed an IPO. Here's a look at the IPO by the numbers. $150 million was raised by Inc. Research through the IPO. The IPO share price was $18.50. $20.49 was the closing price on the first day of trading, which was November 7th. The public shareholders now own Inc. Research is 13.5%, and $533 million is Inc. Research debt. The company said it would use appreciably all of the IPO proceeds to pay down the debt. And Inc. Research employees in the world, North Carolina and Triangle, are 5,500 in the world, 925 in North Carolina, and 800 in the Triangle. And the last number, $56 billion, estimated addressable global clinical development market. Next up, Lauren Onisor's column on technology and entrepreneurship. Her lead article is entitled, Wake Forest RST. Hey, where's the high-speed fiber you promised? Snubbed from inclusion on Google Fiber's maybe list in February, many Wake Forest residents had seen RST Fiber as the answer to their high-speed fantasies when it emerged from stealth mode in March. The small Shelby-based company announced it was bringing fiber internet with or without Google, using the term gigabit state to describe its plan for North Carolina. But months later, residents still aren't connected. It's something we want to make happen by midsummer at the latest, RST Fiber CEO Dan Limerick said in April when asked when Wake Forest would get fiber. Construction crews backed up his words. About 30 houses were connected over the next few months, starting with Crenshaw Manor in Wake Forest. As crews shoveled dirt, RST began accepting pre-registrations for the services. Limerick and town officials spoke frequently, says Roe O'Donnell, deputy town mayor for Wake Forest. But that was then. In the months since, AT&T has announced its own fiber plans. Frontier Communications has connected parts of Durham to the service, including American Tobacco Campus. While some houses in Wake Forest have been connected to RST, a process that required extensive dirt moving and invasive equipment, they have yet to log on. According to O'Donnell, communication between the town and RST has stalled over the past few months, even after RST built out miles of fiber between Wake Forest and Raleigh. O'Donnell says he last spoke with RST a month ago. They said that they were hoping to get back in here in November or December, but as yet they're not here, he says, adding that a recent email implied RST was now focusing on Charlotte. Crenshaw resident Henrik Rasmussen confirms RST work stopped a few months ago. The fiber is hanging out of the side of my house, he says. I understand they are working on the main connection from Wake Forest to Raleigh. Limerick had little to say about the situation on November 5th. The only comment I have on that is RST, being a private company, doesn't have public funding to work with, so right now we are working diligently where our funds permit, which is our area right around where we're located in the Cleveland area and in the Charlotte area, he says. Dan Holt, the Wake Forest activist behind WakeForestFiber.com, says he hasn't spoken to Limerick recently, and his website, which helped connect potential customers to RST, isn't currently in service. He couldn't offer further comment. Joe Fredoso, former CEO of MCNC and head of the Broadband Task Force in Wake Forest, says RST isn't the only option for the town. The Broadband Task Force in Wake Forest continues to discuss advanced broadband deployments with several service providers, he says. We have seen some promising developments in the last several months with a couple of different parties. But for the residents of Crenshaw Manor, fiber options are limited. Since RST Fiber owns the infrastructure and connecting their homes, they are locked in, even if another player steps up. Next up, new MCNC chief targets state's connectivity. Intense. That's how incoming MCNC CEO Gene Davis describes the hiring process. I've been talking to them for the last, 3 months, she says about the network and broadband nonprofit. She found out she nailed the job last week. It's an incredible organization, she says. I think that one of the things we've been talking about so much truly is about how broadband is the infrastructure for our future. So that's how I think I'll approach this. Davis, who says she has an inclusive management style, says she's already strategizing in her head. Fiber, she says, will be a big part of North Carolina's future. This idea of connectivity touches every part of our state and our citizens, she says. We know that in order to be globally competitive, we have to have this high-speed connection for our citizens. Davis, born in Boston, came to North Carolina 22 years ago to work for IBM. She moved directly from Europe for the job. I flew into Miami, drove up, looked around, and said, "This looks good." This week's He Said It portion in Lauren Onisarge's column for covering technology and entrepreneurship is from Mr. Todd Olson. Mr. Olson is the CEO of newly launched product engagement platform startup Pendo, which just raised $1 million in seed funding from the likes of Core Capital Partners, Contour Venture Partners, and Idea Fund Partners. Mr. Olson is quoted as saying, "In today's economy, you want to play to win, and unfortunately, if you just bootstrap along, you just go too slowly." End quote. ThinkHouse looks to expand into new territory. Live-in entrepreneurship program ThinkHouse Live-in entrepreneurship program ThinkHouse has been in operation nearly a year in Boylan Heights, and organizers are already thinking big. "We're thinking about some ideas to expand it," says co-founder and vice president and general manager of data sharing at Citrix, Jesse Lipson. "Maybe outside of pure entrepreneurship." Lipson teams up with his HQ Raleigh founders on the initiative last year, buying the house in downtown Raleigh so that entrepreneurs can focus on their ventures and not on their post-college living expenses. HQ Raleigh Executive Director Jason Wyden has made no secret of the fact that its founders would like to expand the idea outside of Raleigh, but Lipson says ThinkHouse might expand outside of its genre. "One of the things we've noticed is most of the people in ThinkHouse are fresh out of college," he says. "In college, they had a really good community. Oftentimes, you go out after that, and then you're on your own." While it's a great model for entrepreneurs, it could serve other areas, such as education. Lipson thinks a ThinkHouse filled with teachers, for example, and we're thinking about a lot of things, he says. This week's column about e-commerce, written by Lauren Onisarge, is entitled 9.3 Billion Reasons to Pay Attention to Singles Day. A Chinese bachelor holiday, Singles Day, is getting some serious ink. And the press isn't about the holiday itself, which emerged in the mid-90s as an anti-Valentine's Day. It's about the dollar signs, $9.3 billion to be exact. If you're an e-retailer and you haven't heard of Singles Day, chances are you will, says Channel Advisor CEO Scott Wingo. Wingo's Morrisville-based company has created an online dashboard to help e-retailers increase their sales, and one of its partners, Alibaba, is making a big push to turn Singles Day into a global shopping holiday, one that is already putting Black Friday to shame, with or without the United States. U.S. consumers don't really react to it as best as we can tell, Wingo says, but Chinese consumers do. Alibaba reported $9.3 billion in Singles Day sales. Wingo put that into perspective. Black Friday and Cyber Monday made $3 billion in combined sales last year in the U.S. Last year, Singles Day inked $5.8 billion in sales. It could be a big opportunity for U.S. retailers. When we've talked to the folks at Alibaba, one of their biggest challenges is there's a lot of demand for U.S. brands and products and not a lot of supply, he says. And Alibaba, he continues, wants Singles Day to be a global phenomenon and just pulled in $21.8 billion in IPO cash that could help fuel that mission. Next year, I think we'll see a big push for awareness among Americans. Dawn Wallace covers small business personalities and triangle trends for the Triangle Business Journal, and her first column this week is entitled Manicures and More at Expanded Carry Dealership. Leith's Auto Park Honda of Cary has more than doubled in size and added a few perks for customers and employees. Previously in a 32,000-square-foot facility, the dealership now has 85,000 square feet of showroom, service, sales, consulting, training, and storage. Zone sales manager Lance Wolford says he hasn't seen one larger in the region yet. The new facility, constructed beside the old facility, which will serve as the new Auto Park Nissan dealership, has updated features such as an enclosed service bay, a car wash with a conveyor belt, and weekly massages and pedicures for service customers. Instead of driving up, parking your car, and entering the dealership or service entrance to address your concerns, customers now drive their Hondas into a covered bay with heating and air conditioning, where an advisor greets them to address their concerns. It's easier for customers to drive in, says General Manager Danny Williams. We have about 10 advisors. Inside the showroom, each Thursday, service customers can visit an on-site masseuse. And on Mondays, customers can get a manicure while they wait for their car. A kids' room enclosed in glass with toys and a TV is located beside the waiting area where Starbucks coffee is served. I'm impressed, says Wolfer. We are exceedingly happy with this building. It's 3 stories tall, has an elevator, and includes storage beneath the showroom. Beside the heated repair shop sits a photo booth for cars with a rotating wall for 360-degree views for pictures and videos. It also has a car wash that can wash 200 cars in 4 hours. With around 650 cars on the lot at any given point, sales turnover at a rate of 350 cars per month. This is a huge investment for the Honda brand, says Williams. The Cary area sells more Hondas than any other area in the state. It's because of the population growth. And the dealership has 130 employees. It's official. North Carolina small businesses are relying less on SBA loans. This year, small businesses across the state requested about $16 million less in loans from the U.S. Small Business Administration than last year. In 2014, $845 loans were approved, totaling $449 million. Of those, 746 loans were approved through its General Small Business Loan Program for around $383 million. Certified development companies approved 99 loans for $66 million through the SBA's Real Estate and Equipment Loan Program. That's down 3% from last year, when the SBA approved 917 loans for $465 million. According to SBA spokesman Mike Hernandez, even with a slight decline, SBA lending remains stable. With the economy in North Carolina improving, some lenders are following positive economic trends and financing loans conventionally, he says. Between Raleigh, Cary, and Durham, small businesses received almost $70 million in 115 loans. Businesses in Raleigh received 62 loans worth about $37 million, Durham received 33 loans worth $12.5 million, and Cary received 20 loans worth $19 million. You should know that North Carolina clean energy jobs by the numbers. North Carolina is number 5 for the new clean energy job creation during the third quarter of 2014. Here are the numbers as calculated by National Nonpartisan Environmental Policy Group Environmental Entrepreneurs. 18,000 new jobs across 20 states. 12,000 new jobs announced in the second quarter. 876 new jobs were created in North Carolina, 6,556 new jobs in Nevada, the top-ranked state, and 150 new jobs were created in Illinois and Maryland that were ranked 10th. And from the brewery beat, Miller Coors, like Anheuser-Busch InBev, has had a tough year. They're down about 2.1% in shipments through the third quarter, though many of their specialty brands are up. So the North Carolina plant is probably down more. Most of this is due to the declining popularity of light lagers as beer lovers increasingly look for more flavorful beer. And now it's time for a better world. The world of philanthropy is seen through the eyes of Todd Cohen. This week's major article from Mr. Cohen has a spotlight on education. His column is entitled, Center Supports LGBT Community. Last spring, when high schools typically held their proms, 125 teens from throughout the Triangle and their allies gathered at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Raleigh for their own dance. Sponsored by the LGBT Center of Raleigh, a nonprofit that serves 700 to 1,000 youth and adults who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, the Second Chance Prom is one of a handful of programs that aim to create a sense of community and provide support for sexual minority youth. In the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court decision that let stand an appeals court ruling allowing same-sex marriage, the challenge now for the LGBT movement is to continue to work for the same rights and opportunities that most Americans take for granted, says James Miller, executive director of the LGBT Center of Raleigh. Just because you have marriage doesn't mean you are equal in the eyes of the law, he says. We've been fighting for health care, for employment, to make sure people have a place to live. With an annual budget of $350,000, a staff of 2 full-time employees and 1 part-time, and 150 active volunteers from a core of 500 volunteers who clock more than 12,000 hours of volunteer time per year, the LGBT Center is one of only a handful in the South that are thriving, says Miller. In addition to the Second Chance Prom, youth programs at LGBT Center also include Queer North Carolina, which focuses on positive youth development. Aspire, or A Safer Place for Youth to Reach Excellence, a leadership camp held in Greensboro over a 3-day weekend each March, and a monthly get-together in coffee shops that typically attract 30 to 60 teens. Through its SAGE, also known as Services and Advocacy for GLBT Elders, Raleigh Program for People Age 50 and Older, the LGBT Center provides a listserv with 150 subscribers and serves about 300 people who visit the center on a regular basis. It also hosts dances, meets and greets, and lunch and learn sessions on topic on a range of human development issues such as health, retirement, and marriage. Its HealthWorks program provides outreach on health, financial, spiritual, mental, physical, and environmental issues, as well as HIV testing provided at its offices twice a week by the Wake County Health Department. The center provides mainly social and educational programs through its transgender initiative, which serves roughly 500 people a year. A key focus for the center, Miller says, is working with straight allies, supporting policies that are informed finally by education and fact and not by fear, and educating people that the fight is not over. Also in nonprofit news this week, winter's coming and coats are needed. Pump It Up, Gigi's Cupcakes, 919 Magazine, and Pamela Mansuti, broker in charge of the Triangle Real Estate Group West, launched a coat drive for the Haven House Services, which provides comprehensive services to the youth and families of Wake County. The drive began November 1st and runs through the end of the year with drop-offs at the following Raleigh sites. Pump It Up, 10700 World Trade Boulevard, Suite 112. Gigi's Cupcakes, 8521 Briar Creek Parkway, Suite number 105. And Briar Creek Swim and Tennis Pavilion, 10601 Arnold Palmer Drive. You should know that Butterball donates birds for Turkey Day. In 2013, 49 million Americans lived in food insecure households, and North Carolina has a household food insecurity rate of 17.3%. To help ensure local families have Thanksgiving dinner, Butterball is donating 1,900 turkeys to North Carolina families, including 1,236 in the Triangle, and almost 500 to North Carolina-based military families. Turkeys have and will be distributed at Urban Ministries of Durham, Community of Hope in Garner, Archway Foundation Clayton Area Ministries, and Turkeys for the Triangle in Raleigh. This week's Letters to the Editor page, also known as Viewpoint, has The Editor's Notebook by Sukheta Mukherjee, who's the editor of the Triangle Business Journal. His column this week is entitled, The Money Game We Play to Lure Jobs. Sharon Decker, North Carolina's Secretary of Commerce, announced recently that the state's Job Development Investment Grant, JDIG, Corporate Incentive Funds, is out of money. Essentially, the state has pledged almost all the money from the $22.5 million biennial JDIG kitty to companies that have promised thousands of jobs in the coming years. Here's the good news. North Carolina continues to be an attractive state for companies to relocate, expand operations, and bolster the tax base of the communities. Here's the bad news. Legislatures and commerce officials have to restructure the oversight of the JDIG program if they want better results. A recent analysis by WRAL News found out that nearly 40,000 jobs promised by companies that received JDIG grants between 2009 and 2012, about 15,000 jobs have actually been created. That was during the Beverly Perdue administration, but given the appetite of doling out taxpayer money to corporations, it really does not matter whether it's a Democratic or Republican who is sitting at the top. In the past, I have been a vocal critic of the corporate incentive policies undertaken by states to attract big companies. Given the struggles and the fight of existing companies to stay relevant and profitable, I always felt doling out public dollars in the form of cash or credit is tilting the field artificially. If one company prospers in a city because of the public incentives while its competitor in the same city decays because of the disadvantage, how is that sound public policy? Economic developers argue that cash and credit incentives are necessary and is part of today's business, and they assert every state does it. While I largely agree with that analogy, the issue is not that we are doing it. The issue is how we are doing it. In the past decade, North Carolina has had one of the highest unemployment rates in the nation. Buoyed by some economic gains, the jobless rates may have come down, but the underlying economics of instability still exist. If the company is having trouble selling its goods or services, it will close up shop, consolidate its operations, or sell to someone else. And what does that mean? Loss of jobs. And do you know how much time the company board will spend thinking whether they are doing right by the state's corporate incentive program? Zero. Zilch. Nada. The increasing oversight of the JDIG program is an absolute must if legislatures are thinking about replenishing the fund. Perhaps the job schedule needs to be accelerated. Perhaps the companies receiving these large grants and credits have to be told that at least 50% of the architectural, construction, or upfit work needs to be done by a local vendor. This may sound like government intervention in the free market system, but who do you think is paying for those corporate incentives? Every North Carolinian, that's who. In the Raleigh area, in the past few days, two major business stories have evolved. Salix Pharmaceuticals, a multi-billion dollar homegrown pharma company, lost more than $3 billion in market value because it announced an internal audit of its inventory levels. The second story is still being played out. CB&L and Associates, the half-owner and operator of the Triangle Town Center Mall, has put the property in the hands of the lender servicer in light of a $170 million debt payment due next year. Our free market system will determine the losers and winners of these business stories. Whether it be shareholders, bankers, investors, management, or consumers, someone will be financially hurt in the end. Thankfully, the government is not playing a role in these stories. But when you put public dollars in the mix, the storyline changes. Hence, the need for stricter oversight. This week's guest column is from Mr. Dirk DeYoung. Mr. DeYoung is the editor of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Business Journal. His column is entitled, Retailers Open Turkey Day. So, what's the problem? Here we go again. As national retailers roll their Black Friday hours further back into Thanksgiving Day, critics lament how horrible it is that retail workers will be deprived of their inalienable right to enjoy the holiday with their families. Give me a break. On November 10th, Minneapolis-based Target Corporation announced its stores will be open at 6 p.m. on Thanksgiving. Similarly, Best Buy said it will open at 5 p.m. Other national retailers, such as Macy's, will open that evening as well. The litany of complaints followed. The Journal Workforce, for example, argues that workers deserve the chance to eat with their families just like anyone else. Some other national retailers, such as Costco and Menards, are taking advantage of the blowback to not only stay closed on Thanksgiving, but also to advertise how well they are treating their employees, according to Time magazine. My problem with the focus on the sad state of these retail workers is that it's blind to the rest of the labor economy. It's as if these people are the only laborers in the country who have to work on Thanksgiving, and that's hogwash. I've worked many Thanksgivings since I was a teen. I delivered newspapers for the Minneapolis Star, when that paper existed, bused dishes and parked cars at a country club that served Thanksgiving dinner, and covered the news at daily papers that didn't close for the holiday. I'm now fortunate enough to work for a media company that closes on Thanksgiving, but you see journalists working on the holiday by turning on your local TV news. This goes way beyond the news and restaurant businesses, though. Think of all the places staffed on holidays. Hospitals, police departments, airports, convenience stores, movie theaters, homeless shelters, soup kitchens, hotels, six entire NFL teams. The list could go on and on. So why this focus on retail workers? Well, people are generally resistant to change, but especially if it affects them directly. But change is a fact of life in every sector of the business world, and sometimes it sucks. Also, many Americans want to keep this holiday, which conjures up Rockwellian images of extended families gathered around a golden turkey, free of commercial contamination. But that bird flew the coop years ago when the NFL started showing wall-to-wall football on Thanksgiving, liberally interspersed with holiday commercials. Meanwhile, young adults, bored from an entire day with the old folks, head to the bars and movie theaters. So now everyone can shop, too. Big whoop. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.